Blog Talk Radio.
Talk Live 100. I'm your host, Talk. I'm Monte L. Bay, and tonight's broadcast is The Great John and the Divine Warning. Who is the Great John? Who is he? Well, we're going to hear from him tonight, and I'm asking that you listen very, very, very closely, and I'm asking all people inside the United States that's listening to this broadcast to listen to what this man is going to tell us. It's very, very important. He's a very, very powerful man, a very highly respected individual. He has brought to the table more in the 20th century than most men alive. Okay, now, just starting out, I would like to say that I'm Tohaku Amano Bay, and you listen to Morris Talk Live 100, and we are offering our free articles, as always. The 14th Amendment exposed the commerce game, and whether or not you even own your own children. And the way you get that is simply contacting me by email. Just send an email to tarhaka99@yahoo.com, and I'll get that right on to you. It doesn't cost you a dime. Also, for those of you who have a Facebook account, if you have a Facebook account, go ahead and send me your friend request, and I'll honor that. And that way you'll have access to my Walter Hawkins Institute, where articles are placed. Matter of fact, we'll place some there today. You have access to Tohaku Morris American Group, where we put things there in video format. And, of course, all my broadcasts land on my wall. We have created one of the most comprehensive libraries inside the United States, and I'd like to say congratulations to the brothers that got your libraries today. And we've just added over 17 different articles in there as early as yesterday, and we have more pending. On the 22nd of this month, we'll have the Grandmaster Elihu Pleasant Bay. He will be on the broadcast. And then, of course, on the 28th, we have our brother Umar Johnson. And we will also be having our Reverend Hotep. He'll be coming back with us. We're waiting on him to call in so we can do the formalities on that. But, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, let's go straight on into the broadcast.
I was supposed to be here early. They gave me another assignment. They didn't pick me up to go to the assignment. I followed their instructions and waited at the hotel. I would love to be here when I can be more fully in depth on this subject, because there's a whole lot of illusions about Africa's relationship with other people in the world. There's a whole lot of illusion about our relationship to the religions in the world. And these belief systems that had its origin in Africa, all of them, and there is no exception, turned on African people. I said there is no exception. And there's one thing you have to get through your mind and keep it. Nothing that ever came from the European mind was meant to do anything but facilitate European domination of the world. And I said, there's no exception. Everything that was brought into this continent, everything, every idea, every so-called religion was meant to dominate and to control. The Arabs had no illusions about it. The Europeans had no illusions about it. You were the ones with the illusions. And yet every element that went into the making of every major religion in the world started in Africa. Why is it that you are so naive? You let people redress something that you invented, sell it back to you, and enslave you through it. I'm saying that all organized present religions are male chauvinist murder cults. And I say there is no exception. Well, I wanted to be here earlier. I wanted to deal with our relationship with the people of the world and the fact that we created peaceful nations that had no word for jail because no one had ever gone to one. No word for old people's home because no one had ever thrown away grandma and grandpa. No word for orphanage. We did all of this. And over half of human civilization was over before we knew that a European was in the world. Before he wore a shoe or lived in a house that had a window. Now, Africa has always and still is the prize for the whole world. We as a people have always been the world's richest people, culturally rich, mineral rich. We have always been the prize because we have always had and still have something that other people won't, think they can't do without, and don't care to pay for. Because we have always been the prize, we have been under siege for over 3,000 years. Nothing that ever brought into Africa from the outside was meant to do the Africans any good. That means all other religions. Islam was the handmaiden of Arab imperialism. Christianity was the handmaiden of European imperialism. The Hebrew faith was the handmaiden of a concept called the chosen people. Now, if God is kind and God is merciful and God has no stepchildren, he won't choose one over the other. And to say he chose some people, you're making him a bigot. And to say that he endorsed enslavement of one people over the other, you're making him an accessory to murder. The Arabs used Islam to rationalize their slavery and their imperialism. The Europeans used Christianity to rationalize their slavery and imperialism. Who are you kidding about friends in the world? Damn it, if you want a friend, look in the mirror. There's a billion African people on the face of this earth. Why are you buying third-rate junk from third-rate people thinking you can't make it? Why don't you at least make a safety pin to hold your child's diaper together? Who has programmed your mind that thinking you can't make a car? The first man that made a car that had never seen one previously. The Japanese bought locomotives, broke them down and studied them, and had a Japanese technician produce each piece, put it together, and had a much better train than the one they copied from. All knowledge in the world belongs to everybody in the world.
Yes.
Who has programmed our minds in assuming that we cannot run a nation and run it well? The main thing imperialism did, slavery and imperialism, that they removed African people from the respectful commentary of history. And they tell them, something they are still telling them, and all of the organized religions are guilty of this. I favor none of it because Africa didn't need any of it. I'm saying that African belief systems, properly understood, is 10 times better than Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And better for the African. Now, you might have some romance with one of these religions. I have no romance with any of them. I have a romance with reality and truth. And the chips can fall where they may after I tell it. As for friends, you have had no friends. When they discovered you, they began to prey on you. Now let's look at our relationship with Western Asia, mistakenly called the Middle East. For 3,000 years, our greatest enemies came from Western Asia. They were trying to avenge the fact that they were once African colonies. You read a book called When Egypt Ruled the East, and you get some of the basic information on this. Now, the first visitors to Africa came in the 1700 B.C., These were the people who would later be called Hebrews. Now, black people are ticklish on this because black people think that everything in the Bible is true. I question the intelligence of anyone who thinks everything in the Bible is true or supposed to be true. It's allegory, stories told to illustrate a point at a time when there were very few people reading books. And most of what went into the making of the Bible was copied from Egyptian texts. Now, if you want to get so dewy-eyed over the Bible, which is a carbon copy of a carbon copy, why don't you go back and read the original Egyptian text? Then you see where all these stories started from. You see where the story of the Exodus started from. Now, you can so do it as you actually think there was an Exodus. These people walked into Africa. Why couldn't they walk out? Why did they have to go by sea? Why did sea have to part? If you read Egyptian literature, you will discover that the whole story of somebody parting the sea started with about 3,000 years before the Hebrew entrance. I should not use the word Hebrew entrance, but the entrance from Western Asia. Now let's get one thing straight, because black people are confused about all religions. Now I'm not against any religion. I'm a very spiritual human being. I just don't need a preacher to preach no Ten Commandments to me when he's a backslider going with some sister, some other man's wife. I'm intelligent enough to pick from the Ten Commandments, not commandments anyway, but they were omissions of purity at the great school at Luxor, the great African training school. All right, now, let's get into this Western Asia. I'm saying that the people who came from Western Asia escaping famine did not have any Hebrew faith when they came into Africa. And there's no record of a Hebrew faith before there. Why is it that when they left Africa in the so-called Exodus, they had all three? African culture, an African religion, and an African language. Now look at the origin of so-called people you now refer to as Jews. You're mistaken using that reference because the word Jew is of European origin. And the people in Europe who call themselves by their name.
Okay. Now you just heard from the late, great John Henrik Clark.
As for friends, you have had no friends. When they discovered you, they began to prey on you. Now let's look at our relationship with Western Asia, mistakenly called the Middle East. For 3,000 years, our greatest enemies came from Western Asia. They were trying to avenge the fact that they were once African colonies. You read a book called When Egypt Ruled the East, and you get some of the basic information on this. Now, the first visitors to Africa came in the 1700 B.C. These were the people who would later be called Hebrews. Now, black people are ticklish on this because black people think that everything in the Bible is true. I question the intelligence of anyone who thinks everything in the Bible is true or supposed to be true. It's allegory, stories told to illustrate a point at a time when there were very few people reading books. And most of what went into the making of the Bible was copied from Egyptian texts. Now, if you want to get so dewy-eyed over the Bible, which is a carbon copy of a carbon copy, why don't you go back and read the original Egyptian text? Then you see where all these stories started from. You see where the story of the Exodus started from. Now, you get so dewy-eyed, you actually think there was an Exodus. These people walked into Africa. Why couldn't they walk out? Why did they have to go by sea? Why did sea have to part? If you read Egyptian literature, you will discover that the whole story of somebody parting the sea started with about 3,000 years before the Hebrew entrance. I should not use the word Hebrew entrance, before the entrance from Western Asia. Now let's get one thing straight, because black people are confused about all religions. Now, I'm not against any religion. I'm a very spiritual human being. I just don't need a preacher to preach no Ten Commandments to me when he's a backslider going with some sister, some other man's wife. I'm intelligent enough to pick from the Ten Commandments, not commandments anyway, but the omissions of purity at the great school at Luxor, the great African training school. All right, now, let's get into this Western Asia. I'm saying that the people who came from Western Asia escaping famine did not have any Hebrew faith when they came into Africa. And there's no record of a Hebrew faith before there. Why is it that when they left Africa in the so-called Exodus, they had all three? African culture, an African religion, and an African language. Now look at the origin of so-called people you now refer to as Jews. You're mistaken using that reference because the word Jew is of European origin. And the people in Europe who call themselves by their name have no relationship to the biblical people of the Hebrew faith. And I'm saying that the people we now call Jews entered world history with their visit to Africa. And when Africa was invaded, 1675 B.C., instead of joining the Africans who had been their beneficiary and saved them from starvation, they joined the enemies of Africa. No one has ever returned any favors to us. As a people, we have always been hospitable to strangers, mostly the wrong strangers. And what we have to understand now, in the period of superior brainwashing, is there is no European answer for African problems. Either Africans find a solution to African problems, or there is no solution, and if you don't find a solution soon, you go back into slavery. We have to stop all of this nonsense about who belongs to what religion when all of them were imposed on us in the first place. We stop all this fight between Muslims and Christians when neither one of the religions are doing them any good or moving them toward independence. All of them are handmaidens of conquerors. All of them are religions of conquerors. We were naive when we accepted their interpretation of something that we had all along. I'm saying we need to take a good look at ourselves. I'm not talking about burning churches. I'm not talking about getting rid of religion. Understand me well. I am saying that every single thing that touches your life, religious, socially, and politically, must be an instrument of your liberation, or you must throw it into the ash can of history. Develop a liberation Islam. And if you develop a liberation Islam, you have to turn on the supreme slave traders who were in the slave trade 1,000 years before the Europeans, the Arabs. And most brothers who think they're Muslims are merely Arabists, forerunners, vanguards of Arab propaganda. The Arabs are not above joining the Jews against black people. In America, they're already doing it in Detroit. In America, they're already doing it in real estate. You got some dewy-eyed savings. You got a friend. I still ask you to look at that mirror. And if nothing's staring back at you that's friendly, then you've got no friends. So this is why you start friends. All right. I'm saying something which you need to reconsider. I'm saying that everything that came into Africa, every people that came into Africa, did not come to do Africa any good. Everyone and every religion and every people who came into Africa declared war on African culture. They began the bastardization of African people, created confused mulatto who didn't know whether he'd be loyal to his mother's people or his father's people. That confusion is still here. The fascination for the color of the conqueror and the fascination to go to bed with the conqueror. Now that's raw and mean, but it's true. Now, sometime ago, a North African leader, Gaddafi, was sending some Libyans to study in Europe. And he told them what any good nationalist would tell students going to study. I'm not sending you to Europe to find a wife. I'm sending you to Europe to gain the technology to come back and make Libya a strong nation, a strong Islamic nation, and a strong Arab nation. And you cannot achieve any of this between the legs of a European woman. When is somebody going to get strong enough to tell Africans going to school, you're going to come back home and pair up with a sister? But if you want to pair up over there, stay over there. Now, the one thing we have to look at, and I'm sorry, I'm going to have to conclude on this because I've left out a body of information. At the university, I teach an entire course, semester course, on Africa's relationship to other people. And I devote several semesters to Africa before Europe, the consequences of the coming of the Greeks, who stole a lot that they think is their culture, stole a lot that you think is Greek philosophy. We've been the victims of propaganda. And yet, if you read the Journal of African Civilization, other works, we have lived in Europe, we have lived in Asia, we've lived in the Americas. The African people have already proved that they can get along with different people, amalgamate their culture with different people without one hint of a war between them. People who come into Africa immediately declare war on African culture, standards of beauty, standards of conduct, and change the African concept of theirs so they can rule through him. This was true of the Greeks, who began the bastardization, again, the European bastardization of Africa. The Western Asians had begun it 3,000 years ago. This was true of the Greeks, who began the bastardization, again, the European bastardization of Africa. The Western Asians had begun it 3,000 years before that. The Romans, a bunch of well-dressed thugs who could write well but couldn't think, who borrowed exactly everything. They laughed at the African concept of Christianity. The African was practicing and not giving it a name. This is why you don't know nothing about the African origins of Christianity. This is why a whole lot of people will not read Ben Yorkinen's The African Origins of the Major Western Religions, Africa, Mother of Western Civilization, a Black Man of the Now. Because he's telling it like it is, but you also will not read white radicals who identified Africa as the origin of the great religions of the world, especially Alvin Boyd Kuhn in his work, Who is This King of Glory? In Shadow of the Third Century. We have dealt with John Jackson, another radical Black historian, with man, God, and civilization. We let some of our great scholars die in hunger, die wanting for friendship. Now, having devoted my greater portion of my life to scholarship and teaching and digging up information on African people and trying to make African people face reality, I have often said, a point that I wish you to consider, I didn't have to do it. I chose to do it, and if I had to do it over again, I would do it better. A lot of talent other than the talent to teach and to research. I've never met a rich man who had a better mind than me. So if I wanted to succeed as a rich man, I could have done that. I never met a crook who wasn't a fool. I could have been a good crook if I chose to be a crook. I chose to be a teacher of African history. I chose to look in the Bible where I couldn't find my people. I started looking for them in the world, and I didn't stop until I found them. And I know why they are left out of the Bible. I know why all the angels are white. You mean to tell me God is merciful, God is kind, and not one little brown or black angel sneaked into hell? I ain't buying that. Now, the Bible that you get so dewy-eyed over is one of the greatest pieces of propaganda ever written. If you want to read the Bible, why don't you read the Bible one day and read Mein Kampf the next day and see the comparison? That's hard on your mind. Because you think if you don't have Christianity, Islam, or Judaism, you don't have that spirituality. I've got more spirituality after I put all of them down. And I've got more religion after I put all of them down. All right, now let me conclude something that has no conclusion. We have to look at the impact of Europeans on Africa. All impacts have been negative. The Romans laughed at the early African Christians. Finally, for political reasons, they stopped killing Christians and became Christians. I'm saying the Europeans became Christians for political reasons, as the Arabs became Muslim for political reasons, and as the so-called Jews became Hebrews for political reasons. People use organizations for political reasons, and what we get so dewy-eyed and think we're dealing with, all the truth. If you look at indigenous African religious belief systems, if you look at the idea when Africans had no churches of any consequence, because these fools came here and said, this is the house of God, and the African looked at that church and said, if God who made the wind, the spring, made the ocean roar, and you gonna tell me he can fit into a little thing you call a church? That is no house of God. So some of them had the common sense enough to move away from it, and some had the common sense to burn it down. I'm saying that you are closer to God when the further way you get away from organized religions that are all handmaidens of conquest. The Roman Empire developed during the early period of Christianity. Remember, the Roman Empire started in Africa. It rose in Africa. It fell in Africa. A lot of people need to stop reading some religious books and read some straight history without fable, without supposition, without myth. Read straight history. Read the Mediterranean world in ancient times. She's a racist bigot, but her chronology is good. And there's a good history of the Europeans trying to move out of Europe into the Mediterranean to find something to eat to put on that gosh darn awful European food. He has solved his problems at the expense of other people. The slave trade liberated Europe from the depressed economy they had created with the so-called Crusades and through the famines and the plague. Europe always solved its problems by preying on people outside of Europe. They are in a position right now that they have betrayed true socialism, which was not of European origin in the first place. And some people are confused between Karl Marx and Groucho Marx. I think a lot of people are Groucho Marxism instead of Karl Marxism. They're funny people. And if you think that that system started in Europe, no system as humane as socialism could have started among a bunch of icebox people who pay on their brothers for their breakfast. Read Palmer and Colson's work, The History of the Modern World, especially the early chapters. Now, the evidence of Africans in the New World, the evidence of 1,000 years of civilization before slavery, all of this I'm not discussing because there is no time. But when the Romans disgraced themselves in the mismanagement of Christianity, they created a vacuum. Islam moved into that vacuum. The Africans thought that Islam would get the Romans off of their back. They were right. Islam got the Romans off of their back, and the Arabs jumped on their back, and they're still there, using Islam to justify it. Now, the African military man, because we are the greatest fighting machine in the face of the earth, if we ever discovered this, people going to start running. Under proper leadership, proper inspiration, properly equipped, the black man is the greatest human fighting machine God ever created, if indeed God created it. I think the gods of Africa created it. Once you lose track of your heritage, you lose track of your liberty in this world. The Europeans doing the slave trade not only read the African out of history, they colonized history, they colonized information about history. They colonized image. They colonized the image of God. Who told you Christ was white? He was born in that part of the world predominantly occupied by non-European people. So you should not get into the argument about whether he's white. All you have to say, was he a Greek? No. Was he a Roman? No. But these were the only people partially white in the area at the time. If he wasn't a Greek, he wasn't a Roman, he was one of those other people. You don't have to argue about the shades of color. So far as you're concerned, once you establish he was not a Roman, he was not a Greek, your conversation is over. If somebody else want to argue about his shade, well, that's their problem. And if you got a problem with color, then you got a problem with your mother and your father. You have insulted your mother and your father if you don't like what they gave you. I wear mine like a badge of honor. I dig it. I wear it well.
All right. Love it.
If somebody else want to argue about his shade, well, that's their problem. And if you got a problem with color, then you got a problem with your mother and your father. You have insulted your mother and your father if you don't like what they gave you. I wear mine like a badge of honor. I dig it. I wear it well.
All right. Love it.
I'm saying, in closing, and I am closing, that what you have to do is take a holistic look. Now, that's not only at your position in the world, but your potential in the world. You have to learn how to convert everything into an instrument of liberation or leave it alone. You have to realize there were no Greek fraternities and sororities until they were introduced to secret African societies. People get all dewy eyes over something that was imposed on them in order to control them without understanding that that's another imperial effort. So it bothers me, and although I have good personal friends who are Muslim, that not a single Muslim scholar have dealt with that 1,000 years of African independence before slavery and how the Arabs from the north systematically destroyed these nations. They actually, it did not occur. 1591, from Morocco, an army was launched against these great independent stations, independent nations in inner West Africa. These were great states, and because of poor communication between African and African, there was enough army in these states to march down to the coast and to drive every slave trader into the sea. But the communication between African and Africa was so poor. Even today, the East Africa is not too clear about what's happening in West Africa. And nobody knows what's happening in North Africa because the conspiracy to hold on to Africa is happening in South Africa and in North Africa. So the whites in North and South Africa willing to play a part, and the pseudo whites in North Africa willing to play a part. In all this world, you have no friends. But if there are a billion of you on the face of this earth, scattered all over the world, what do you need with the friends other than yourself? Why can't you turn inward on yourself and say, I will wear no clothes I don't produce. Start with your underwear. I wear no shoes that's not made by a brother. You're creating a shoe factory, employment at once. Start buying aeroplanes, break them down and study them, later on make aeroplanes. What this whole thing is about is the restoration of confidence. It has been the role of these handmaidens of colonialism to destroy your confidence in yourself. You don't believe that you can look like a god. You don't believe a black father in your home is to some extent a god. That doesn't make the black woman less than a goddess. Because we produced the first human society that recognized and respected the female god. We produced the first human society that you can't be a king unless you got a queen. You can't be a god unless you got a goddess. So you can see all of these social ills that people are defending now, none of it started in our countries. I defy anyone alive, and those who want to come alive, come back and prove me, I invite them too, to show me one single case of sexual deviance or maladjustment any place on the African continent for the coming of foreigners. I defy you to show me one case of teenage pregnancy, one case of ill treatment of women, We got confused with someone else's ideas, someone else's concept and definition of us. What we have to understand is that faith has not spared us for an idle reason. A whole lot of people who've been hit less than us are extinct. What is there in us that made us strong enough to take this heavy blow? 500 years of slavery, one way or the other, slavery, neo-colonialism. What made us strong enough to survive? What has faith saved us to do? And inasmuch as we gave the world its first humanity, faith has saved us to give the world its last humanity. What we have to do is to believe it, to believe that we are worthy of it, and to believe that we are capable of it. What black studies should be about, what black religion should be about, is the restoration of the confidence, and the restoration of the confidence that we must rule the state again. That is not an imitation nation, that not an independent nation in Africa or the Caribbean Islands. They're all imitation European states. And what we have to understand is that the nation state is stagnant. The African did not live in a nation state. He lived in a territorial state. The African learned something very basic. Cultures have to be fertilized by cultures. People have to be fertilized by the interaction between cultures and cultures. This insecure European tightened his borders. You know, you got a passport to come here? The word passport is not in any African language. The things he invented to restrict himself, he imposed on other people. Once we gain confidence in ourselves, and once we look at that person staring back at us from that mirror and like what we see, and don't move from that mirror until you like what you see. Then, in coordination with other African people throughout the world, we will give the world a new lease on life. We will turn to all of our people and not one part of them, because we came from a matrilineal society that respected women to the point the lineage came down to the female side. We must answer the call of the great African-American poet, Margaret Walker, who said, "Let the dirges end. Let a new peace begin. Let us write a new covenant for the freedom of ourselves in the world." African men throughout the world need to step forward and answer Sister Margaret and say, "Sister Margaret, we have heard your call, and because we have never been a society that excluded women, with our women at our side, we are ready to pick up the challenge. We are ready to start a revolution that will change the world. We won't get ready tomorrow because tomorrow's things are left to tomorrow. We will start our revolution right now, and we will start it with ourselves." Thank you.
You've been listening to the late, great John Henrik Clark. John Henrik Clark. And that is a very, very powerful message. And I hope that you all have gotten something out of that. He's a very, very powerful speaker, and he always has. He's had his own library in his house for years and years, long before he passed, thousands of books that he had written, his own books as well. That was John Henrik Clark. Now, also, I'd like to mention that for those of you who are just tuning in, If you all have a Facebook account or Twitter or a Dig or MySpace or Black Planet, if you would send me your friend request, I'll go ahead and grant it, and that will give you access to my Facebook wall. And there you can visit the Tahakas Institute, where we put articles and information there for you, those for people who are attempting to know something about the nationality or your sovereignty or what have you, or dealing with the courts, the mortgage companies, or whatever. Also, we have the Tahaka Moorish American group, and there we place videos for your education. So you can go straight there and look at the videos. So I'm encouraging you to do that. I'm also encouraging you to just simply send me an email for your free articles, the 14th Amendment Exposed, the Commerce Game and How to Play, and whether or not you even own your own children. These are the articles that we send to you through email attachment. And the way you get that is just contact me at tahaka99@yahoo.com. That's tahaka99@yahoo.com. We've also created one of the most comprehensive libraries inside the United States. And the way you access that is simply contacting me by telephone, area code 904-303-9061. We are going
to
go now.
Were relatively late in West Africa to justify their Fugitive Slave Law Act, which what they was doing was snatching up free brothers and sisters over here and say, you escaped slave that we brought over in West Africa. This was the game that was played. And you even see petitions that were circulated by brothers and sisters back then saying, we against these Fugitive Slave Law Acts because you're just snatching up free brothers and sisters. Brothers might be rolling down a Mississippi in a canoe or whatever, and you snatch them up saying he's an escaped slave that y'all brought in slave markets in over in Africa. This was a game that was played. Why? Because they had to get you out from your rightful name as Moors. Moors. Why? Because there were treaties involved. There were international treaties that stated that they could not enslave you if you was a Moor. That's why when you look in the Black Coast of Virginia, it said all these are considered slaves except for Moors and Turks and Amity. And Amity meaning that you have an outstanding treaty of peace and friendship. So they couldn't slave you as Moors. So they had to snatch up your children at birth, switch them up to some other place, and raise them up, tell them, oh, you descendants of some Africans that we brought in West Africa. You see what I'm saying? And that did two things. That denied them of their aboriginal rights of being here before Columbus in this hemisphere. And at the same time, it put them in the category of chattel property. All right? So whenever we call ourselves by those names, we put ourselves in that same category. See, the Moors, you know, we deal with science, Moorish science, you know. So if I was to ask you, how do you identify yourself, and if you was to tell me black, I would say, no, that's not an identification of yourself. That's, black is an adjective. An adjective describes a thing, but it does not identify a thing. And if you say you were black, I would say that was an unscientific or inaccurate description at that, because you're not really black. You're various shades of brown. So not only is that description does not identify you, but it's an inaccurate description of you at that. If you tell me you African-American, well, Africa is a continent made up of many nations. So when you say African, you're not identifying yourself, you're not connecting yourself to any nation with any continuity of laws, treaties, and so on and so forth. So when you say African-American, that's like, well, you have no established rights in the history of law that we could go by. You see what I'm saying? This is why the prophet squarely said Moorish American. That tied us into the illustrious past of our ancestors, as well as all the international treaties that was involved. And this was a nation, an empire that was recognized the world over. So now you tie yourself to something that's tangible, with a flag, with a historical context, with landmass, treaties, so on and so forth. All right? He says, and I'm just going to take a seat right now while I'm doing this. I fasted today, so I'm a little, you know how you get when you fast, you know. It says, I, the prophet, was prepared by the great God Allah to warn my people to repent from their sinful ways and go back to that state of mind of their forefathers, divine and national principles, that they will be law abiders and receive the divine right as citizens according to the free national constitution that was prepared for all free national beings. And let me stop right there, that they will be law abiders. You know, that's something that our people are not. You know, we as a matter of fact, we go out of our way to not be law abiders. But there's a reason for that. You know, with us, you know, if you break the law, you get over the law. That's like us. That's something worthy of praise with us. Why? Because we on the outside looking in. That's why the prophet said to return us back into constitutional fold, because just like cells of the body, if you have your body's made up of many different cells. Let's say your legs, so let's say you laid up in the bed in the hospital for whatever reason, and you don't use your legs. The muscle cells in your legs begin to die. They begin to atrophy. Why? Because there's a self-destruct mechanism in those cells that tells that cell that if I'm not being utilized, I'm going to commit suicide, because at that point I'm just being an extra burden for the body. So every cell in the body has a self-destruct or a suicide mode that kicks in when it feels it's not being utilized or used by the body. It's not an active participant within the body. Well, that's the same thing with us, with regards to the United States of America. For so long, we believed or we thought we were something that wasn't used by it, that we wasn't part of it. And so within us, a self-destruct mode kicked in, where we were desirous to do all kinds of things that was destructive to ourselves as well as to the nation, not realizing that our forefathers played a key role in the formation of this nation, but not knowing that we're antagonistic to it. We see ourselves on the outside of it, and because of that, that self-destruct mechanism has kicked in within us. It kicks in any human being. That's why when you are part of a society, one of the worst things, one of the worst punishments or penalties is exile. Because once you exile, that self-destruct mechanism kicked in. That's what happened with Malcolm X. It's no coincidence that shortly after he was exiled from the nation, he passed on shortly afterwards. Because that self-destruct mechanism kicked in, he started getting paranoid. You know, you remember the picture where you see him by the window with the rifle? All these things start to kick in. And he started feeling as if he was going to die any minute now. And it became a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's no coincidence that shortly after Minister Collin was exiled from the nation, that he passed on. This is a very powerful thing that operates within the human being on a subconscious level. And so whenever you're part of any society and you're thrown out, you start having suicidal thoughts, you start getting paranoid, you start having all kinds of things because now you're outside of the body. He says outside the constitutional fold, any nation is just like a corporation. And a corporation comes from the word corpus or body. That's why they refer to it as a body politic. Each one of us functioning as cells within that body. So if you see yourself as outside of it, then you're going to do all things destructive to yourself and to that same body that you don't see yourself a part of. And this is why Nobu Ali understood that fact. He says, they are to, talking about us, they are to claim their own free national name and religion. Free national name and religion, that identifies you with a landmass, with a nation, and your religion gives you self-determination, the right to live according to your own principles. See, the prophet also understood the fact that within religious, as a result of the doctrine of religious freedom, if you proclaimed your religion, then within that, you have self-determination. You could do any act or forbear to do any act for conscience sake as long as it's in tune with your religion and not harmful to society as a whole. He says here, there is but one issue to them to be recognized by this government and the nation of the earth, and it comes only through connection with the Moorish divine national movement, which is incorporated in this government and recognized by all other nations of the world. And through it, they and their children can receive their divine rights unmolested by other citizens. Notice he mentions a Moorish divine and national movement. Divine means, the divine aspect of it is you see the Moorish science temples. That's the divine aspect. That's the religious side. That's where you go to perfect the temple, to purify yourself, so that at that point you could partake in the national aspect of the movement, which is the government aspect. That's the self-determination aspect. And so the prophet put it in the right order. He didn't put the cart before the horse. He said, first come into the temples, clean up your act, clean up your ways, and then you are fit to partake and form government, not the other way around. If we just jumped off of here and just try to put together a government with the same type of Negro mentality, it would collapse overnight. And so he said, this is a Moorish divine national movement. So first we got to perfect the divine aspect, and then we could put together the proper national or governmental aspect. All right? He said that they can cast a free national ballot at the polls under the free national constitution of the United States government and not under a granted privilege, as has been the existing condition for many generations. And that goes back to the whole civil rights thing. These are granted privileges that are legislated. These are legislated rights or privileges. They're not rights. They're not birthrights. They're not rights that you are born with. These things are legislated by legislatures. And they could write it out.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, we have gone into the divine warning, and you are listening to Brother Hakeem Bey as he delivers the divine warning, which are the words of Noble Drew Ali, the prophet Noble Drew Ali. And we are going into the next plug on the divine warning.
All right, so we don't want granted privileges. We don't want legislated civil rights. We want to function under our divine birthrights, all right, which they now also call human rights, all right? You who doubt whether I, the prophet, and my principles are right for the redemption of my people, go to those that know the law in City Hall and among the officials in your government and ask them under intelligent tone, and they will be glad to render you a favorable reply, for they are glad to see me bring you out of the darkness into light. Money doesn't make the man. It is free national standards and power that make a man a nation. See, free national standards are that which a nation has, which no other nation could change or affect or influence or alter. Your free national standards as a nation, as a Moorish nation, cannot be touched by others. That involves your flag. That involves your principles, love, truth, freedom, love, truth, peace, freedom, and justice. Those national standards that we have, our grand body, all these are national standards set up within our governmental framework, and the free national standards of any nation cannot be tampered with by another nation or any other government. So that's why it's key for us to establish these national standards, because they cannot be touched by anyone else other than ourselves. The wealth of all national governments, gold and silver commerce, belongs to the citizens alone. And without your national citizenship by name and principle, you have no true wealth. That's so key, because you see what's happening now with the whole reparations movement. If you do not come in your true free national name, we will never get anything, because you come in as property. You come in either as property or you come under names that have no standing. African, they're saying there's no nation by that name. We don't owe nothing to a nation that don't exist. You got to come correct. They're looking at it saying, well, wait, look, the title to this says Moorish. So y'all better go back, study some more, come back when y'all ready. You see, this is why what he's saying here is so important. All the wealth of a nation belongs to the citizens alone. Remember, it was the citizens that formed the government. The wealth belongs to them as well. Think about it. Before the government was formed via the Constitution, talking about the United States of America, you just had the people, and they had their wealth. Nothing belonged to the government because the government wasn't formed yet. When they came together to form the government, the most the government do and the bankers do, they are what is referred to as fiduciary agents. A fiduciary agent does not possess or own the wealth, their duty is to manage it for the benefit of another. It's almost like a trustee in a trust. So when you put your money in a bank, and this bank has so-and-so assets or so-and-so, the bank does not own that money. You, the depositors, own that money. They just have the right to invest it and do whatever else they do it for, but it's for your benefit. All right? So the wealth belongs to us, the citizens. Now, what this country has done is a couple of months after the prophet passed July 20th, 1929, a few months later, the stock market crashed. Now, when you look deeper into it, you will see that in reality, one of the reasons why the stock market crashed is because many of them became aware of what the prophet had did. They said in 1928, the prophet went to Havana, Cuba, to the Pan-American Conference. And at that time, he received a mandate for our land in this hemisphere, as well as our wealth. And he came back here and consolidated in the form of an express trust. Well, they say that word leaked out and got to Wall Street. And when they realized that the wealth was, in a sense, pulled out from underneath them, they panicked. And since the whole thing was built on credit, maybe only 10% was actual real money, but the whole thing collapsed like a deck of cards. And America was forced to declare bankruptcy. And just like you have a Chapter 11 bankruptcy, the same thing with this country, a reorganization. And the reorganization plan was known as the New Deal. That was the reorganization plan. When you've seen Franklin Delano Roosevelt, FDR came before the American public and he was doing those fireside chats, he was telling the American people in so many words. He couldn't outrightly tell them because it would cause even further panic. But what he was actually saying was that they was going to reorganize the whole political economic structure of the nation. And this is what took place between 1933 and 1938. At that time, all the states capitulated and gave up their sovereignty. This is what that whole European sovereign patriot militia group thing was about, is that when they discovered what took place as a result of the New Deal, they still kept the tie to the United States of America. Everything was the same. Just like some corporations go bankrupt, they still keep the same name, just everything is payable to a trustee, court-appointed trustee. Well, that's the same thing happened with America, and in a sense, the Federal Reserve became the trustee. That's why when you look on the money, it's not backed up by gold or silver. As a matter of fact, every dollar in circulation is loaned into circulation. That money is loaned into circulation, which means what? This country has a debt of all that money in circulation. Well, who's the collateral for that debt? You and I, via the birth certificates. Via those birth certificates, because that becomes part of what's known as a sestuque trust to say that, yeah, we could borrow this money from the Federal Reserve because we got collateral in the form of human resources. You see what I'm saying? You got physical resources, gold, silver, so on and so, and you got human resources. And so they have you down. They have us down as human resources via that birth certificate. All right? And so this is the game that was played, and you will find that most of the people here, as a result of that reconstruction, that reorganization, everybody was put on the footing of 14th Amendment citizens. Unless you outrightly proclaim otherwise. And so if the wealth belongs to the nation, belongs to the people, the citizens, and we are the citizens taught by the prophet who proclaim the true citizenship, then right now the wealth belongs to us. Because they don't belong to 14th Amendment citizens. And the majority of people out here now are 14th Amendment citizens. And so we understand it properly, and we put forth our true Morris American citizenship, then really we're the only true citizens left standing if we really understand it properly. All right? And so it was another point I wanted to make with regards to the whole New Deal thing. Also, after that time, for the first time, right after the prophet, the seal with the eye and the pyramid was put in a dollar bill. That was the first time that many Americans seen that seal. Up to that time, all they seen was this seal. This seal was revealed one time at the World Fair in 1881. And those who didn't see it at that time, they didn't see it afterwards. This seal was well hidden. As a matter of fact, America never cut the die for the seal. The reason why they never cut the die for the seal, because the die already existed long before America was created. So why would they cut the die for something that was already in existence? They just presently cannot use that seal because that's our seal. See, you had two nations here, well involved in one. That's why this is the only nation with a two-sided seal. E pluribus unum, out of many, one. And so you have two nations here well involved in one. But what happened was that when the Europeans through the Union Society stood up, we sat down. We stopped functioning as a society. One reason was because many of us tried to run over to this side. We wanted to be like them. We wanted to be Christians. We wanted to be part of their program. And that's what the prophet said. We didn't honor the principles of our forefathers and our foremothers. And that's why we suffer slavery. He said every nation on the earth has suffered slavery. Because at some point in time, every nation has ran against the principles of their forefathers and their foremothers. And because of that, they have suffered slavery. Well, that's what happened to us. We chasing after them, trying to be Puerto Rican. We trying to be Christian. We became Moriscos. Moriscos are those Moors who convert to Christianity either through force or through their own motives. All right? And that's why this ceased to function. And the Europeans said, no problem. We sweep it under the rug, and y'all forget about it. We go ahead and do our thing. You see what I'm saying? It wasn't until the prophet came and said, wait, what's all the stuff y'all got hidden underneath there? Pulled out the flag, pulled out, and told them, put our seal back on the money. And at first, the elders said that they tried to put on the $100 bill. And the prophet said, no, put on the $1 bill, because our people don't even handle the $100 bill. Put it on the most handled piece of paper on the planet Earth today so everyone can see it. And we see it every day, but we don't realize the whole history that's on the back of this thing. It's all here. All right? And I'm going to show you something. And the brother Todd, he showed you at the time, but at the time, some of you didn't see it. And so I want to show it to you here on our seal. You have on our seal, on our Morrison Temple Quran, you see the circle 7, right? Well, here you have the seal of the United States, annual coeptus, right? Novus Ordo Seclorum, new order of the ages. This new order was born in the Continental Congress between the Moors and the European Masons. The Moors and the European Masons, we said, look, us Moors, we enslaved you. You turned around. You enslaved us. At this point, let's let bygones be bygones. Let's form a new order. The two of us. And this is why it says Novus Ordo e pluribus unum. Out of many different peoples and nations, one. The original United States was known as the Continental United States that involved all the free national peoples in this hemisphere. El Salvador, Nicaragua, Venezuela, all these. And you notice that many of these were also referred to as Masonic republics. And in many of these Masonic republics, when you look at their seal or coat of arms, you see what? You see the fez, or what they call a soft fez, or the liberty cap. When you look at the coat of arms for New York State, when you look at the coat of arms for the Army, you're going to see the same red fez in there because this was the foundation of the whole thing. Now, here you see the seal, right? Well, if you take the seal and turn it upside down, you have the circle 7. Here's the 7. Here's the circle. Circle 7. All right? And so this is our seal of our forefathers in this hemisphere. Again, he says, money doesn't make the man. It is free national standards and power that make a man and a nation. The wealth of all national governments, gold and silver commerce, belongs to the citizens alone, and without your national citizenship, by name and principle, you have no true wealth. And I am hereby calling on all true citizens that stand for a national free government and the enforcement of the Constitution to help me in my great missionary work, because I need support from all true American citizens of the United States of America. Help me to save my people who have fallen from the constitutional laws of this government. See, we have to make them understand that us, by us returning into the constitutional fold, by us coming back into our own, they, the Europeans, will also benefit. You see, and by conveying that fact, we won't encounter the same degree of antagonism against us. See, we got to be very wise about this. This is a very powerful nation. Sun Tzu, The Art of War, when you read it, teaches you that if you are going against an enemy and he is more superior to you in certain ways, you don't fight them and you don't fight him on that level where he's more superior to you. You take it to another level where you render that superiority inoperative. You see what I'm saying? So that's why it's important for us to take it to the level of law and divine law, because at that point, all those weapons, all those guns don't function in that particular arena, in that particular theater of war. And so the best way is that Sun Tzu also said that when you go up against an enemy, you never back up an enemy into a corner with no way out. Because I don't care what it is, you back a squirrel up in the corner with no way out, it's going to attack you with all it got. What you do is you back up the enemy into a corner, and then you give them a way out that you determine. That will be the optimal course of action. But you never leave them without a way out. And you try and give them a way out, too, that will allow them to save face, that will make it easier for them to take that particular route. So here dealing with America, we have to make them understand that what we're doing as Moors, we're not trying to overthrow the government. We're not talking about violent uprising and all that foolishness like that. We'd be fools to even advocate that, given what they have. We'd be fools to even talk that language. I remember some of the elders said that in the 60s, some of the Moors started talking all that stuff, that rhetoric, you know, from the Black Power Movement, and they said that the FBI stepped to them and told the Moors, y'all better control those Moors, because it was your forefathers who put us in power to protect this government that your forefathers set up. And we'll take out anyone who try and overthrow that which your own forefathers set up. That's why when you look on the King Alfred plan, the whole COINTELPRO, and they list all the different organizations that they listed there, you don't see the Moore Science Temple of America listed there. Out of all the organizations, you don't see the Moore Science Temple of America listed there, because that's not what we're about. We're about returning this nation, our people, and this nation back to the original divine plan that was originally laid out. It was a divine plan. America didn't happen by chance. All this was part of the divine plan that this would come about. The Moors then had a plan for a new world order, a one world, new world order. That was a Moorish plan originally. The Europeans inherited that plan through the Masonic Lodge, which was the vehicle by which we civilized and taught the Europeans. And so now when we hear them saying it, we ready to throw out the baby with the bathwater, thinking it's from them. No, we originally laid out that plan for one divine world order, and they merely inherited it. And when we fell off, they still espoused it, even though many of them are not carrying out right and exact, because you got to understand that the European Masons who run this government, who run the international scene, that they're under certain oaths and obligations. There's certain things that they can't do. There's certain things that they can't speak on. They're functioning more or less in a custodial capacity or fiduciary capacity. They will make custodians. When we were falling from power, we said, all right, you see this throne? We're going to make you custodians of this throne. You're going to become the keepers of the light, not the bearers of the light. We were the bearers of the light. We were the one who was able to actually go out there and re-educate the whole human family of planet Earth. We made them keepers, which means that it's for so much they can speak on. You look at their degree structure. Water freezes at what? 32 degrees, right? Well, the highest they go is 32 degrees, which means what? Their wisdom, their water, their wisdom is locked up. It's froze shut. They can't get out here teaching like we can. It's froze shut. And maybe once in a while, one of them may be honored with the honorary 33rd degree, and then they throw it out a little more. Maybe they can say a few things, but not too much. You see what I'm saying? And so we put those Europeans in power when we fell from power, because at that time, the Catholic Church, through the Franciscan and Dominican orders was destroying everything that the Moors had built up. All the civilization, all the high science that we had developed and cultivated and built up, they was destroying on a global level. And so we put the Europeans and nations in power. We refer to them as the Mystic Turks, or chief protectors of the sacred shrine. The shrine of what? The shrine of Moor science, of Moor civilization that we had cultivated for so long. We put them there in charge of it. And so they're custodians. And it sometimes happens that custodians forget their place and they start to think that they're the ones. But we got to remind them, y'all not the ones. Y'all the custodians. Y'all was to hold it and preserve it until we wake back up and then get this thing back on its original divine plan. So we are to convey to America that we're not about overthrowing this. No. As a matter of fact, we're about getting this thing back functioning on its original divine purpose. Because if we don't, it's going to be destroyed. As you see what's happening right now on a global level, America's going down a path now of self-destruction. And if we don't wake up and first save ourselves and then in turn save America, it's going to be all over with. And that's where we're going to get.
Okay, that was the second part of the divine warning. We will go into the third part, but I see we have a caller on the line with his hand raised. I'm going to open up the line, and this is area code 214. I'm going to open up your line. Tell me who you are and where you are calling from.
Hi, this is Crystal Mason. Can you hear me?
Yes,
can
I can
hear you
very well. Yes, I can.
This is Sister LaMisha calling from Dallas.
Okay, all right.
I'm doing fine. I'm so delighted hearing all of that information. I definitely want to make sure that I can, I don't know if you have that available on a DVD or if you have it in your archive for me to sit with my family over the weekend to listen to, because it's very, very powerful. I would like to hear
okay,
the whole
well,
complete
It is definitely in the archives. You can also listen to the entire video segments on the same thing. This is Brother Hakeem Bey. You type his name into your browser on YouTube and go there, and you can listen to the entire, I think it's, 11 different episodes, and you can listen to it in its entirety. But we are going to attempt to do the whole thing here this evening because we have the entire 11 segments on this show, and we're going to our segment 5 now. And the first part of the show was the great John, when the late great John Henry Clark came on, and he did his message there. So I'm going to be posting the show after it is done, and so if you want to, you can catch the entire show right there on Facebook. You can go to my wall. You can just take it and catch it in the original news feed.
Okay. Now, quick question. I did catch the latter part of the John Henry Clark. All I need to know is that I don't know if you included that whole segment that he did as well, and
yeah.
You know, if you didn't, then I'd like to just have the name of both of these segments that I could look up myself and listen to the whole thing.
Okay, well, John Henry Clark, he only did 4 segments. They're approximately 10 minutes long, and all 4
mm-hmm.
segments are on this broadcast. That's what we started out with, is the Great John. So it is on this broadcast here.
Okay.
And if you want to go to YouTube and check out the video on all 4 of these plugs, you can do that as well. You simply type his name in there, and Western Religion versus African Spiritualism by John Henry Clark. Now you can catch it there.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. We're still listening in.
All right. Well, we're going to number 5, and I appreciate you calling in, sister.
Okay, thanks.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. Okay, let us continue with plug 5.
And that's where we're going to get some of the other prophecies that the prophet spoke about. Continuing on with that same divine warning to the nation, he goes on to say, I am dependent on your support to get them back to the constitutional fold again, that they will learn to love instead of hate and will live according to love, truth, peace, freedom, and justice, supporting our free national constitution of the United States. See, that's why he's saying that they will learn to love instead of hate. When you are part of something, then you can love it. Then you can uphold it. But as long as you think you want the outside of the fold, on the outside of it, those self-destruct tendencies kick in. And that's why you see it so destructive all over America right now, because we don't feel like we're part of anything. We don't have nothing. We don't have nothing at stake. So we just about, especially Generation X. You know, Generation X was born right at that time of the Civil Rights Movement, and so now that you had either both parents working, or you had single parent-headed households with that single parents working two or three jobs, and so Generation X became what they call latchkey kids. You know, they came home, they opened, you know, they had their own little key, they had to come in, they had to fix themselves a little something, whatever they had. They were running the streets because there was nobody home. So Generation X, for the most part, was basically raised in the streets. When you look at hip-hop culture, all that was a culture that was born in the streets of New York by latchkey kids. We didn't have nothing else to do. We'd get home from school. You know, there's nothing else to do. We get in the schoolyard. We start doing some beats. We started coming up with our own style of clothes, dressing, our own graffiti, our own art style, our own language, our own music, our own everything, basically, because we was on the outside of the society looking in. And so that same generation had no respect for authority, because authority more or less rejected that generation. When parents' authority came, they say, well, who are y'all to tell us what to do? We raised ourselves out here in the streets. Who are y'all to come tell us now what to do? And that's the mentality of Generation X. But Generation X has a special mission. They have a special job to fulfill, according to the prophet. Generation X was the one that the prophet referred to as New Moors. And in the prophet's prophecy, he said that there will come New Moors who will come in with their eyes wide open, seeing and knowing, and that they will take you old Moors, put you in the back seat, and they will fulfill my law. So what he's saying, the prophet knew that after he left, that the Moorish temple would take a downturn. It would go down, mainly because the ones who it was turned over to, the most they were able to do was preserve it. They didn't fully understand everything that the prophet brought. That's why the prophet said it would take you more than 50 years to figure out what I've done. And he said, what I brought is for the third and fourth generation and for the unborn generations, because he knew that generation didn't fully understand what he had. And the most they could do was, and because they didn't understand it, all they could do was preserve it. They couldn't evolve it to make it meet and address the needs of the times. You see what I'm saying? So they inherited it, and they just kept it exactly as it was, and they were too scared to evolve it because they didn't fully understand it. And so that's why it lost touch with the brothers and sisters in the streets, because it didn't adapt to the changes in time, and it was no longer speaking their language. And so that's why you had a situation before this present Moorish Renaissance of us New Moors. You had maybe, you go to temples, you see maybe a handful, maybe five people, mostly all elders. You rarely see anyone from Generation X sitting up in them. It wasn't until now, the Moorish Renaissance of now, which started right around the period of 1990, that now you got Moors, you got all these Moors coming out of the woodworks now all over the nation. This is what the prophet had prophesied would happen. But what happened, there's another thing that happened also. Because most of those Moors actually learned more science in the streets as opposed to the temple, a lot of them had no desire to even get into the temple. So now you have a situation now where you have maybe 5 out of every 10 Moors in the nation right now never even been in a temple. They learned it in the streets. But there has to be a coming together, because that's part of the prophet's prophecy too. He said there will come new Moors who will come in with their eyes wide open. He didn't say stay on the outside of the temple looking in. He said they will come in with their eyes wide open. And so that's where we at now, because I was one of those Moors also. I was brought up into this in the streets. We had lessons that were circulating in the streets. I never even set foot in a temple. I just became a member of the Morris Science Temple this year. So all those years since 92, I was never even officially a member of the temple. And at that time, I didn't even have no desire to be a member because at that time, to me, there was too much conflict over this, over that one, over this one, over that one, over stuff that took place before I was even born. So I said, instead of me getting all caught up in that, let me just deal with the science. And so, but now, I have entered in to the Moore Science Temple with my eyes wide open. I'm coming in with nationality. I'm coming in with attribute and title. That's what the prophet was saying. He's saying they will come in. You got Moors now coming into the temple with those things that the temple was supposed to teach them to get. They're coming in with it already. And so that's why some of them are coming in kind of arrogant. You know, they're coming in like, man, what are they talking about? They don't know this. They don't know that. They don't, you know, to the young Moors, the new Moors, the elders are too slow and sluggish. It's like a story I heard one time. I'm in the middle now. I came from the new Moors. But now I'm in the temple. I'm up there with the elders. I'm working with Shikembe Bay, who's about, what, 70, 71 years old, 72 years old. And I'm trying to bridge that gap with him. On one hand, all them young Moors coming up in the temple in New York City, Harlem, all those brothers from the Zulu Nation, they ready to get busy. These young brothers are ready to get busy. So they anxious. They coming up in the temple. They challenging everybody. I had to pull the young brothers to the side and say, look, y'all. Y'all got to cool out with that. I know where y'all coming from. I feel y'all on that. But what you're doing is not strategic. What you should do is come in humble. Respect all the rules and regulations of the temple and respect the leadership. Don't come into the public meetings challenging the leadership and you say you're a member of the temple, you challenging the leadership of the temple of the temple in public. How does that look to the new people who's coming in? They're saying, well, and how to look to the Europeans? The Europeans were saying, well, look, they don't even respect their own leadership. How do they expect us to respect them? I told them, brother, I said, look, what y'all not doing is not strategic. What y'all need to do is come in humble. I said, the elder generation that preserved it now, they're about to pass the mantle of power down to us, our generation. So your shoulders got, but if you come in and you rant and rave and challenge leadership, what's going to happen is that they're going to put you outside of the temple, which has already happened on a couple of incidents within the temple there. And I said, at that point, your shoulders are not going to be in place to inherit the mantle of leadership when it comes down. What you should do is come in, and when you get in the proper position, then bring up those issues where it would mean something. Don't bring them up in a public meeting where it's just going to cause confusion. And they said, you know, Brother Hakeem, you're right. That would be more strategic, you know, because we soldiers, you know what I'm saying? And we got to understand, we got to study things like the art of war so that we may move strategically. The goal is to be victorious. The goal is not to, sometimes you might have to lose a few battles to win the war. And so I'm trying to hold those soldiers, the new Moors, and check, say, look, calm down. It's going to be a time, but just be humble right now. On the same token, I'm coming to the elders now and telling the elders, look, these young brothers and sisters, they hungry, they ready to get busy. I said, y'all can put them off for a little while, but you're not going to be able to put them off too long. I said, it's going to be a situation like that story of the Maasai warriors that one time an incident took place and something happened. They did something to the their tribe, and the warriors were ready to go to war. And the elder said, be patient. Give us your ear. Just be patient for a minute. Give us your ear. Let us speak to you. And the warriors said, all right. They listened to the elders. The elders said, don't go to war. The warriors chilled out, right? Something else happened. The warriors again was ready to go to war. The elder said, no, give us your ear. Listen to us. So they sat down and listened to him again, right? And they didn't go to war that time. The third time something happened, the elder said, give us your ear. The warriors took their blades, cut off the ear, gave it to the elders, and went to war. And I told the elders, that's the same thing that may happen if they're not careful. The young ones, they're restless. They'll be patient for a time being, but you can't put them off too long. So it has to be that balance between the young and the old. I told the young brothers and sisters, I said, look, that prophet said that the new Moors will come in with their eyes wide open, seeing and knowing, and that they will put the old Moors in the back seat, not outside the car. So don't try and put them out.
Okay.
Dominican American. But we call ourselves names that nobody recognizes. That's why nobody's recognizing us. Only one, the only time they recognize us is when we come under what the prophets refer to us as, and I'm going to show you some things dealing with that. He says here, he says, none of them will recognize them socially, religiously, politically, economically, etc., in their present condition of endeavorment, in which they themselves try to force upon a civilized world. They will not refrain from their sinful ways of action, and their deeds have brought Jim Crowism, segregation, and everything that brings harm to human beings on earth. And they fought the Southerners for all these great misuses, but I have traveled in the South and have examined conditions there, and it is the very work of my people continually practicing the things which bring dishonor, disgrace, and disrespect to any nation that lives the life. And he said he went to the South and seen these things. This is a coincidence. Now you got Generation X down in the corner, the dirty South. Well, that's what the prophet was calling it back then when he went down there. He said they were doing things down there that brought dishonor, disgrace, and disrespect. He said, and I am hereby calling on all true American citizens for moral support and finance to help me in my great missionary work to bring my people out of darkness into marvelous light. And that was the warning that the prophet gave the nation at that time. Now, many things the prophet did was recognized. Right here in Pennsylvania, this is taken from the House of Representatives, Resolution number 75. Most Moors are familiar with this. Notice the date, April 17th, 1933. This is right around the time of the New Deal, and this is back in 1933, so it's not like, you know, us Moors, we're some new jacks on the scene or whatever. This dates back to 1933, where it was recognized that we have the right to use our titles of Il, Ali, Bey, so on and so forth. And it says, I have acquired a right to use, not the privilege, the right, all right? So that's just one example of what the prophet was saying, that what he was doing was recognized by the nations of the world as well as this government. And it specifically referred to us as Moorish-Americans. Moorish-Americans. All right? That's our nationality. Just to give you another example of how it's recognized by the nations of the world, including Morocco. This is a transcript of a speech. Oh, man, I wish I could get the whole thing on there. This is a transcript of a speech given by His Excellency Mayati Diorio, Ambassador of Morocco, at the Moor Centennial Celebration honoring Noble Jouali, January 11th, 1986. He, the ambassador, says, it is a privilege for me and for other staff members of the Embassy of Morocco to attend this, the Noble Jouali Centennial Tribute Dinner. Please let me take this opportunity to express to you our collective appreciation for your kind invitation and my personal appreciation for having been chosen to receive the Ambassador of the Faith Award. I am greatly honored. It is also a pleasure for us to be in the company of such distinguished guests as those here tonight and to be taking part in such a joyous celebration. We are happy to bring you all greetings from His Majesty King Hassan II and the people of Morocco. By now, I have been made well aware of your devotion to strengthening the ties linking the Moorish American community to Morocco. Morocco, for its part, welcomes your interest and your work for a better understanding between us. I would like you to know that your efforts have not gone unnoticed. Your initiative is to be both respected and encouraged. As to us, we in turn have every intention of doing all possible to make our relationship a vibrant and a special one. But for this goal to be met, we must also look to the future. We cannot limit ourselves to considering just the historical aspect of our relationship, thereby believing that good relations between us is a matter of faith. So they don't recognize who we are here, but they're saying, let's look to the future. Let's not look just to the past, the history, and think that's just fate that has brought us together. Rather, we should understand our cooperation to be a living entity, able to grow and open to the future. It is here that we can begin to recognize the importance of our children's role. Whatever advances we make, it is our children who have to follow through. Morocco is awaiting your proposals. That is key. They're sitting there saying, we're waiting for y'all. When y'all get together, when we're ready to form banks, when we're ready to do something, they're waiting for us. But we have to get ourselves together first. I just thought that statement was so key. He's saying that Morocco is awaiting your proposals. We are pleased and proud to have the Moorish community as one of the bridges between Morocco and the United States. As a new voice in a network of our long-standing relationship, Thank you. So, again, what the prophet did was recognized not only here, but by other nations, including Morocco. They want to relate. They're waiting for us. Me and a brother one time visited the council in New York City one time, and we laid out the whole history about the Moors here in this hemisphere, and he was astounded. He was like, we're going to put you in touch with King Hassan II, who was still alive at that time. And he said also what he wanted us to do was translate the journals and stuff into Arabic and start linking up with the college students and the university students over there in Morocco, the ones of our generation, so we could begin making relations with them. See, there's so much that we could do. At one time I studied, if we was to form a bank, right, based on Islamic principles, I didn't say Islamic bank per se, but based on Islamic principles of interest-free banking. When I was in college, I did a research paper on interest-free banking, and it sounds crazy to think that you could do a bank without charging interest, interest-free banking, is that possible? And I wrote to Pakistan, I wrote to Malaysia, and I wrote to another country, I can't remember offhand, who had Islamic banks. And they sent me all the information about their banks, everything, and I showed in the paper how it's possible. See, in Islamic interest-free banking, what happens is that, see, interest is something, or usury, as it's called, usury, is something that's injurious to brotherhood and sisterhood. Because now you take a loan from the bank now, and now you're obligated to pay back not only the principal, but the interest. Let's say you run into hard times, and whatever happens, you lose a limb or whatever happens, you know what I'm saying? During a time when you cannot pay off the principal, the interest is still piling up on you and becoming a greater and greater burden, and that puts you in a position of bondage to me now because I have all this debt hanging over your head. But in Islamic interest-free banking, they don't go by interest, which is a fixed rate. They go by what they call Shirkat Ina and Mudariba, which is a form of partnership or profit set sharing. It's a profit loss sharing situation where I'm investing in you. If you do good, I do good. If you do bad, I do bad. We share in the profit and the losses. This is why when you look at Islamic interest-free banks, they always have a management component there that assists new businesses because they want to see that business do good because it's in their interest that you do good. When you do good, they will also do good. You see what I'm saying? And that's why they have a management team that's part of that bank to assist the business to make sure that they do good. And that's what you call true brotherhood and sisterhood. That's what we want to implement amongst ourselves. So let's say, given the climate now, we have a problem with calling it Islamic bank. I can understand that, but we can apply the principles and not call it Islamic bank per se. But if we was to apply those principles, do you know that Islamic countries will be throwing money into that bank? If you were to set up a bank in this country based on Islamic principles, you will have so much money being poured into that bank. And so that's one of the things as we're in the process now of putting together our grand body. See, the grand body that was set up by the prophet is key because that grand body is the interface between the Moors and the UN society. It is that delegation that pulls a step to UN society and say, we want our reparations and we want it to come in this form. And it's that same body that is to allocate those reparations to be used properly. Not just to be given to individuals who go out there and buy Escalades and all this foolishness like that, and we still don't have no nation, but allocated to build our schools, to build our housing, to build all those things that we're supposed to be doing as a nation. And so we're in the process of building our grand body, and, you know, naturally there's going to be an economic aspect to it, and one of the things I was going to suggest is that we eventually got to form a bank, because you need bank to finance the different projects and to finance different things that need to be done, but that we use these principles. And we will be very successful if we were to utilize those principles. Here's a picture from the convention from 1920. I just shown this to show, you know, the impact that the Moors had at that time in 1928. Here you see, here's the prophet here. And here you see other Moors. And I want to show you this also. This is a report from the newspaper regarding the convention that was held in 1928. I better start touching on some of the prophecy. You know what I'm going to do? Hold on. What I want to do at this point is I want to start touching on some of the prophecies that the prophet made regarding what would happen if his warning is not heeded. And you can see now, in light of current events, it's going to make a lot of sense. You might want to turn that light back on over there. In light of the current events, this is going to make a lot of sense, a lot of things he's saying. For instance, this was taken from a book published by Olive Ill called The Oral Statements and Prophecies of the Prophet Noble Drew Ali. And this is a prophecy. This book here, it's almost like Hadith. It's almost like a form of Hadith amongst the Moors, because it's collected from various people who knew the prophet, who was around at that time. It's just taking different statements from them of things that the prophet said and done and so on and so forth. So that analogy would be in Islam, Orthodox Islam would be a hadith. So naturally, some things have more weight than others. You know, it hasn't been weighted as of yet. And in Orthodox Islam, the hadith have been weighted so that certain things are given more authority than others. But this has not been weighted yet. One day probably it will be. One of the things the prophet said there is, quote, he said that one day there's going to be a holy war. Now, what do you hear being taught about so much right now? All this talk about jihad, holy war. Well, you're going to see the prophet. Now, keep in mind now, the prophet's speaking in 1928. This is 1928 now. At that time, I don't even think Saudi Arabia, the whole oil thing wasn't going on yet. All you had there was desert sheiks, poor desert sheiks roaming the desert at this point. And it was right around this time that the big oil company stepped up in there and said, we'll develop your oil, we'll do the profit, da, 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 and we'll make you rich. And that's why you see all them countries are filthy rich right now, was because of this deal that was made right around this time. So you didn't have all this talk about jihad, holy war, whatever, against America, all that stuff at that time. He said, one day there's going to be a holy war. Prophecy number 168 says, now check this out. It says, quote, one day you are going to look out into the streets, and the streets are going to be filled with men with turbans and fezes, and the highways are going to be blocked. Check out what else he says. He said, quote, keep this in mind, this is if his warning is not heeded, he said, you are going to be saved in a conflict that cannot be told in words. He also told the Moors, he said, one day the European is going to let you down. You are going to have to put up a 90-day supply of food to last you until your brothers come to rescue you from the East. So right there, he's telling you, start preparing. Because he also said here also, he said here, if I were you, this is prophecy number 198, if I were you, I will get ready before you are made to do so. He's saying, get ready now. Don't wait till the last minute. Till you're forced to, he says, start getting ready now. Put up your 90-day supply of food. Have your beans. Have your stuff stored up. You never know what's going to happen. People think, you know, sometimes we think, oh, everything's fine. Don't be caught up by like those ones in Noah's time. You know, there was party and everything. They say, oh, look at Noah. He's crazy. Building a boat. I mean, and not to say that this happened literally, but the symbolic understanding of it, they were partying. Here he is building a boat on dry land. They thought he was a fool. They was having a good time. Here he, a man building a boat on dry land on top of a mountain or whatever. But then when the water started rising up, they was all banging on the boat. Let us in. We don't want to be caught off guard like that. So prepare. As far as I'm concerned, every family, every household should have a survival kit. A basic survival kit of food that you stored up, flashlights. Tent, I mean, you name it. I got a little kit. I got a number of kits. I got all kind of stuff in there. Stuff that I went to, like, camper supply stores and got, because you never know if you may even be out of doors. You might not be able to stay up on the home. So you got to remember, America, 85% of America is pure wilderness. The cities only take up 15% of America. So you got to understand, the first thing going to go is the cities. When you have outbreaks of smallpox, isn't it ironic? You remember the last meeting? I was speaking about religious freedom. I was speaking about how if America said mass vaccination of smallpox, how we could say we don't want to get it under religious freedom. Right after that, didn't the president announce mass smallpox and vaccination everything? So it's just showing you we got to stay in tune with the times. The prophet also said, quote, prophecy number 57, he says, quote, watch the newspapers and listen to the radio. I am going to make the European tell the truth. So we said in the last days, listen carefully. What you hear in the newspapers, what you see on the news. He said he's going to make them tell the truth at that time. And if you listen carefully, you could distinguish the truth from what they're saying. He also said that, this is deep, because he said this in 1928 before anything about smart bombs. You heard about all the smart bombs with laser accuracy. He said that, quote, one day bombs are going to fall so that they won't miss a spot as wide as my shoe. He said that you are going to need a basement to hide in. You know, almost like bunkers. And he's describing smart bombs right there. He's saying that it's going to be so accurate that it's going to land in space, not even, won't miss a spot even as wide as a shoe. So he's already predicting this. All the technology, smart bombs, all that stuff. Another prophecy he says here. He's predicting FEMA before FEMA. FEMA is the Federal Emergency Management Agency. And FEMA has a series of plans that was signed into law, a series of executive orders that are signed to law that if the president declares a state of national emergency, FEMA takes over all railroad, transportation, food supply, everything, and everybody has to register with the Postmaster General, where you will be allowed either to a work camp or detention center or whatever the case may be. That's why the Postmaster General, the post office in every neighborhood. So what better mechanism to round up everybody and to assign them where they are to go than through the post offices, all right? And that's through FEMA, Federal Emergency Management Agency. That's why when the riots broke out in Los Angeles, and the president came on and said, I declare a state of emergency for Los Angeles, and riots broke out of the cities, I thought at that time they were going to elevate it to a state of national emergency. So at that time, right around that time, that's when I started getting my survival kit together, because I knew it could be on at any moment. That's the same time I started going out to the woods with Rudy Duckett, Brother Abdul Hakim Rashan, studying the different herbs, survival foods, all that, because I wanted to know how to be able to survive in the woods if I have to, and know the foods that's available in the winter as well as the summer, because the prophet also said this also. He said, and this is deep, and this is something I always thought about. He said, quote, number 163, quote, pray that you don't have to make your flight in the wintertime. And it goes on to say that we should pray that we do not have to make our flight from destruction at the end of time in the wintertime. The destruction is going to be bad enough without the added problem, ice and snow, to make our situation more difficult. Knows that always their wars, they plan right around that same time, right around wintertime. The last Gulf War was right around wintertime. Right now, it's right around wintertime when they're planning it. You see? So this way, if things break down, people ain't going to have an outlet in the wilderness type of thing. It make it easier for them to round you up because you'll be kept, you know, indoors more or less. You see? So you got to understand that. You got to really know and understand survival. Like they say, I have to put out a survival manual called, it says survival on the bottom. It says, if you fail the plan, you plan to fail. You see what I'm saying? You got to be ready. Sometimes when I go out in the woods, I walk through the woods with my children sometimes, and I said, while we walking through here, let's formulate a meal. And so we walk, and I say, all right, there goes some mustard, garlic, there goes some of this, there goes some of that. I'm actually trying to compose a meal as I'm walking, because I say to myself, it may come a time where I'm stranded. I don't even have access to my survival kit. I might have to know how to improvise and survive right there. Go out with my children, we make lean-to shelter, you know, just get in practice, just for fun. Because a day may come where you might have to live like that. I asked my sons one day, I said, if you was in the woods and you had to cook something and you don't have no pots or pans, how would you cook it? I said, let's say you wanted to boil water. I said, how would you do it? And they were thinking, they were like, all right, you can't make a pot out of leaves or something like that, because the minute you put it on the fire, it's going to burn up. You can't make it out of wood, it'll burn up. So how would you do it, you know? And they thought about it. I said, this is the way the elders used to do it. They dig a hole, line it with something, and you boil and heat up stones and rocks, and you drop that into it, and it will bring the water to a boil, or it will cook whatever you want to cook. And I just use that for example to say that these are things we got to think about. I'd be thinking about these things while I'm in the woods, because you never know. You never know what may happen. The prophet also said He said, quote, all nations will turn against the United States one day. Well, you see happening right now. I mean, that's why the prophet said, if you don't believe my prophecies, he said, if you don't believe I'm a prophet, watch my prophecies. Another prophecy from the prophet, he said that, now this is before FEMA. He told the Moors that one day you will go to the store and there will be soldiers with guns and bayonets in front of them, and they will not let you enter, and they will order you to move on. And that's exactly what happened when they declared the state of national emergency, that they will be in front of all the stores. Every neighborhood only got a 72-hour supply of food. Every neighborhood only has 72 hours worth of food within that neighborhood in the stores. Imagine if there was a major crisis here, economic collapse, because you got to understand something. Those so-called terrorists, they're not just into blowing up buildings. That's not their strategy. That's not what it's about. Their strategy is to bring about an economic collapse by destroying the faith and confidence of the people. Haven't you noticed that every time there's a major crisis that the stock market goes down? See, their thing is, the whole stock market is not just based on science and mathematics like you may think. It's based a lot, majority, on emotion. I had to do a paper in college about that at one time, that the stock market is not just based on facts and figures, but it's based primarily or more importantly on emotions and a degree of confidence that the people have. This piece of paper is not backed up by anything. It's not backed up by gold or silver. Only thing that's backing this thing up is a mutually agreed upon convention where you say, I recognize this as being worth a dollar if you recognize this as being worth a dollar. And that faith and confidence in that is the only thing holding this thing up. The minute you lose confidence that this is worth a dollar, it's gone. It'll be laying in the streets. And the prophet said that one day too. He said one day it will be $20 bills in the street, and you pick it up and it'll be like leaves in the street. It won't have no meaning. Because there's nothing backing it up. It's just fate. This money system is like religion. It's literally a religion. Why do you think the book about the Federal Reserve was called Secrets of the Temple? It's like a religion, America, by destroying the faith and confidence that the people have in the system. People scared to do that. Things start to collapse economically. You see, so that's what may happen in this country. Imagine if there's an economic collapse. There's no more transportation. There's no more food distribution. Water gets cut off in the city. You can't flush your toilet. You imagine what the cities are going to be like? The cities are going to be death camps. It's going to be like that movie Escape from New York. You're going to have so much disease and so much things going on. And I'm not saying this to scare y'all. I'm just saying this to prepare y'all, like the prophet said. The prophet said that, he said prepare before you are made to do so. This may never happen. I'm not saying get paranoid like those kids who get crazy paranoid and they get crazy with it. You know, survival every day, walking around in army fatigues. And I'm not saying spook out with it. I'm saying prepare your survival kit and go on with life. But you still got plan B. In other words, you got your peacetime plan. Everything's cool. Everything's functioning. Everything's all right. But then you got your emergency plan also. Don't neglect that. All right? The prophet also said, one day the Europeans are going to lock the food up in warehouses, put soldiers around them to guard them, and you will go anywhere he says to go to get something to eat. The prophet also said that there is going to be an earthquake that will split the United States in two. He may be referring to a physical earthquake, or he may be referring to some type of political upheaval that will split the country in two. All right? He also said that one day 50-pound hailstones are going to fall. And you see all these crazy storms that's taking place across the country now? We headed right for that. What he's saying is that, in a sense, is that the weather's going to freak out. And remember that time there was this Category 6 tornado? And they said, well, wait a minute. There's not supposed to be no such thing as a Category 6. According to science, the way the earth is set up, you cannot have a category 6 on the planet earth. Yeah, you had one. A category 6 that was a half mile wide hurricane. All right? These are the type of things that happen because what's happening is that an imbalance. He said that, our people, when we in tune, when we in peace and harmony, the earth is in peace and harmony. When we out of tune and then we out of harmony, the planet's out of harmony. That's why he said that he has to get our people out of their sin because literally, our state, our condition will bring about the destruction of America. That's what he was telling them. He was saying, I got to save them from their great sin in order to save America. Because if not, they're going to destroy America just through their own vibes, through their own mindset they're going to destroy it. They're going to cause all kinds of earthquakes, hell, all kinds of things. That's what our people are doing because we so messed up. And we've messed up anything that's around us because we have a direct connection with the forces of nature. And so when we out of whack, nature's out of whack. And that's why you see all this crazy stuff happening all over the planet now. The whole weather system's changing. The North Pole and the South Pole are melting. Whole chunks are melting. People who live in the coastlines, it's going to be underwater soon. Because as those ice melts, the water level rises. And so you got that going on as well. All right. Another prophecy says that, he said, if my principles are carried out, the United States will be the richest, most prosperous country on the earth. If not, the worst is yet to come. He also said, quote, there is going to be famine in the land. So you got to prepare. You have to prepare for these things. You have all these chemical and biological agents being released. Another thing, another prophecy said, he said, one day, some of you old Moors, he said new Moors, some of you old Moors are going to be so hungry that you are going to bite into your own flesh and blood will skeet out, and you are going to get angry with yourself because you didn't put up enough food. Some of you take it for granted. He's saying you're going to regret that day when it comes. He said that, the Holy Prophet said that things are going to go back to the horse and buggy days. What he's saying there is that technology is going to fail. And we're going to be turned back to a pre-industrial revolution state of technology. That's why I'm encouraging the Moors so much to study Moorish Spain and the technology and stuff of Moorish Spain, because that was pre-industrial revolution, yet they established a standard of living that they was living better than we live now. They had running water. They had street lights lighted that was lit. They had beautiful homes, marbles, fountains, everything. If we could, and that was before the Industrial Revolution. So we should study that technology, because that's stuff that we could implement. If things go back to the horse and buggy days, we could still live in a way that is high standard of living. All right? Another thing, I'm going to read a couple more, and then we're going to take a break, and then I'll come back and we'll take time for questions and answers. This is deep. Let me see how I should introduce this one. I'm going to throw it out there. Maybe y'all going to have questions about this later. The prophet said, quote, I have got airplanes, zeppelins, and apparatus. I'm going to take my good Moors up in the apparatus on an incline until it's all over with. Now, that's kind of a deep statement here. You know, there's a lot to be read into that. I'm going to read it one more time. The prophet said that I have got airplanes, zeppelins, and apparatus. I'm going to take my good Moors up in an apparatus on an incline until it's all over with. And some look at that symbolically. Some look at that as being dealing with something that's on a deeper level. Another prophecy he said.
Okay, I'm going to have to stop here. And I hope that you all have gotten something out of this broadcast. We've been listening to Brother Hakeem Bey in the Divine Warning, describing the prophecy of Noble Drew Ali. And you've been listening to Tahaka Amana El Bey on Moorish Talk Live 100. And I'm going to need you to stay tuned for our future broadcast. And don't forget, the Grandmaster himself will be here on the 22nd of December, Elihu Pleasant Bey, and followed by Brother Umar John on the 28th. And until next time, ladies and gentlemen.
been too long between.